From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor David Paymer. He stars in the new film Quiz Show as the producer of the rigged game show. Paymer was nominated for an Academy Award for his role as Billy Crystal's put-upon brother in Mr. Saturday Night. Also, we talk about pitching with Baseball Hall of Famer Bob Gibson. He has a new autobiography. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews R.E.M.'s new recording. And are feminists and multiculturalists causing the downfall of Western culture? Maureen Corrigan reviews Harold Bloom's new book, The Western Canon, The Books and School of the Modern Age. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Bosnian Serbs say the discovery of 16 Serbian soldiers and four female nurses brutally murdered could ignite the Sarajevo area. A group of Bosnian Serbs says the grisly slayings have made the Bosnian region a tinderbox. United Nations peacekeepers found the bodies today and said they were mutilated. The senior UN officer in Sarajevo says the act was likely carried out by Bosnian government troops. He's appealed for calm. The UN fears retaliation by the Bosnian Serbs. South African President Nelson Mandela received a thundering welcome today from a joint meeting of Congress. He's in the United States to win business investment in his country. He thanked the U.S. lawmakers today for their part in helping to end apartheid and setting free and fair elections.
We were moved because you, like the great humanity to which we all belong, had committed your own human and material resources to ensure that for the first time in the entire history of our country, the people had the possibility to elect a government of their choice.
Mandela is warning that poverty and illiteracy still have many South Africans trapped. He's calling on the United States for support to help South Africans make the most of their freedom. The House is considering the issue of the U.S. military presence in Haiti again. A vote is expected today on whether to set a deadline for the withdrawal of American troops. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
House Democrats seeking to avoid an embarrassing vote have drafted a resolution that would authorize the Haiti operation through March 1st. If troops were to remain in Haiti after March 1st, Congress would vote again. President Clinton expressed confidence that American forces would not be pulled into a deeper military mission, but Congress doesn't want to be left on the sidelines. Members of both parties have insisted on congressional authorization even after troops were sent to Haiti. The House and Senate have both already passed resolutions commending the diplomatic mission led by former President Jimmy Carter. Republicans in the House proposed an alternative resolution that criticizes the president for ordering the invasion in the first place, calls for an immediate withdrawal of troops, and requires a vote by the end of January if forces are still in Haiti. The Senate is also expected to vote on another Haiti resolution before adjourning. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Swiss police say initial autopsies find some of the dead in the apparent mass suicide there yesterday were given a powerful drug before they died. An investigator told a news conference in Switzerland the theory of mass suicide has not been fully ruled out, but some evidence is beginning to make investigators think of executions. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down nearly 15 points at 37.72. This is NPR. Senate Republicans have blocked a lobbying reform bill intended to stop the influence of special interests on lawmakers. Senators voted 52-46 to keep alive a GOP filibuster against the measure. It imposes a virtual ban on gifts and requires lawmakers to disclose what they do receive. Opponents of the bill say they're alarmed by a new interpretation of provisions that would force greater disclosure of grassroots lobbying work. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell labeled these objections a fiction, and he says they're a smokescreen for senators who object to genuine reform. Democrats charge this is a part of a large GOP strategy to deny Democrats any new accomplishment before the November elections. The House of Representatives has approved a conference report that increases the threshold for a nanny tax to $1,000 a year. The nanny tax is the Social Security tax paid for domestic help. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Though it was never meant to be, says House Democrat Barbara Kennelly of Connecticut, the so-called nanny tax attacks the 14-year-old babysitter. Right now, anyone who pays $50 or more in 3 months' time to domestic help is required to pay Social Security. Kennelly says this is Congress's chance to end gridlock.
I hear about how we can't move forward and help the American people. The nanny tax is an example where we can, in a bipartisan fashion, make it easier for American people to do their duty and obey the law.
The House passed the conference report unanimously. The bill now goes back to the Senate for final approval. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
Japan says it may extend emergency help to the earthquake-shattered Kuril Islands. Aftershocks from Tuesday's strong earthquake are still being felt. Most of the damage and all but one of the deaths have been in the Kuriles. These are remote islands north of Japan, occupied by Russia after World War II, and the focus of a tug-of-war between both countries. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, David Paymer, is one of the stars of the film Quisho. It's the story behind one of the biggest scandals in TV history, when the public learned in 1958 that the game show 21 was fixed. Contestants were sometimes provided with the questions before airtime. David Paymer plays the producer of the quiz show. Paymer won an Academy Award nomination for his role in Billy Crystal's movie Mr. Saturday Night. He also worked with Crystal in City Slickers and its sequel. Here's a scene from Quiz Show in which Paymer, as producer Dan Enright, tells contestant Herb Stemple, played by John Turturro, that it's time for him to throw the game.
You lose when I tell you to lose.
Oh. It's an arrangement. It's always been an arrangement.
If you told me to lose before, if you told me to lose right from the beginning, then I'd understand. That'd be the story of my life. But why now? What did I do?
Look at the big picture. It's not like television is going to go away, you know? I mean, think about the future.
You mean like a panel show?
Yeah, check. Now, the last category is movies. We're going to ask you what won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 1955. You don't know it? You answer on the waterfront.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Don't do that. Not Marty. I saw Marty 3 times. The best picture from 2 years ago, and I don't know it?
Someone of your intellect, and it's such a simple question. Don't you see the drama of that?
Drama?
Herb, don't do this to yourself.
Please, let me lose on a physics question. Not Marty, Dan. Don't do this to me. It's too humiliating.
For 70 grand, Herb, you can afford to be humiliated.
Although game show producer Dan Enright sounds like the villain of the story, actor David Paymer told me he didn't play it that way.
You know, Dan Enright, what he was really concerned about was ratings and putting on a dramatic show. And I even watched interviews with him in his later years, and all he would talk about was drama. We wanted drama. And he was really following a long tradition of rigging, or the euphemism, I suppose, was controlling these quiz shows that dated back to the 40s in radio. And, you know, Dan Enright was trying to create a dramatic show, and in a way he thought that he was educating the country. And I sort of took that tack as an actor, that my character felt he was doing a good thing for the country, that he was sort of opening up education and knowledge and intellect for the school children of America. So I played him as a college dean, mm-hmm. not as the bad guy.
Did you ever watch any of the game shows that Dan Enright produced?
Yeah, Robert Redford gave us these kinescopes of the original shows of 21, a lot of the shows that are depicted in the film. And it's quite fascinating to watch these contestants in retrospect. Some of them were very good actors, actually. But then again, some of them, when you watch it now, it's almost laughable. And you wondered, you know, why didn't the American public realize they were being duped? Because, well, they'd ask questions like, what was the name of Paul Revere's horse? And then these contestants would be like, let me think. I mean, a question like that, usually either you know it or you don't. And they're taking all this time and really being dramatic, like Enright told them to. And some of it looks quite fake.
Of course, so much on TV from that period looks fake to us now.
Well, that's true, I guess. And I suppose, well, it's a testament to the power of the medium, of that very new medium at the time, that when people saw it coming over the airwaves, they just believed it, you know?
Though I have to say, you know, like Wheel of Fortune isn't exactly verite. You know, I mean, guishas have never looked exactly real.
Right, right. But I guess it's really the line that Scorsese says in the movie when he says, Scorsese, playing one of the sponsors, says, well, the quiz shows will be back. They're just going to have to ask easier questions because the American people, really, they don't care about the questions or the answers. They're just following the money. And, well, Jeopardy's sometimes difficult, though, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Well,
at least if you play double Jeopardy.
Now, what did you do to get the look of the era?
Yeah, and what a look. talk about unflattering.
Didn't like those glasses?
Someone said to me after seeing me, gee, Dave, you have absolutely no ego at all. It's so great. I mean, you know, what does that mean? Well, I know what it means. Well, you know, Dan Enright didn't have the greatest hairstyle in the world. And actually, Redford suggested a hairpiece for me, which is really not flattering at all because it's sort of that bacon strips, you know, combed, you know, brought over from the side, and it looks terrible. And then these dark glasses, sort of like the Steve Allen glasses of the 50s, but really thick, which is what Enright wore back then, too. So I was looking at a lot of pictures of Enright, and, you know, it's not really my... it's not really my choice of a way to look, but I think it worked for the role.
What was it like to work with Robert Redford as your director? Do you think he has any insights by virtue of having worked as an actor for so many years?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Redford is absolutely an actor's director. And by that I mean he knows how to speak with actors. He knows how to talk with them. He knows how to communicate what it is he needs in a scene. I like to say that Redford knows the actor's secret handshake. He can just say a word or two and make you understand what he's talking about.
What's one of those words he said to you that helped?
Well, for me it was economy. I can be sort of like a nervous guy, a little neurotic, a deal of anxiety here sometimes. And when I started rehearsing Enright, I was sort of moving my hands a lot while I was talking and trying to convince Van Doren, for instance, to go on the show, or the rigged show. And Redford said to me, you know, there's an authority thing, Dave, and it's just economy. It's just not moving around so much in your seat, not using the hands so much. And if you watch my performance, there's a stillness to it that is very different from a lot of the other roles I've played.
Mm-hmm.
And in that stillness comes authority, and it really worked for me. I mean, it's amazing. It's hard to just sit still because you've got all this nervous energy as an actor, but Redford showed me a way to kind of rein that in, and it worked very well for the character.
So how did you get the part in Quiz Show?
Well, Robert Redford had seen me in Mr. Saturday Night and really liked my work in that. And I was playing sort of, for part of Mr. Saturday Night, I was playing a guy who was in the 50s, Billy Crystal's brother and producer of Billy Crystal's, Buddy Young's television show. So I sort of had that 50s look in the younger scenes in Mr. Saturday Night. And Redford called me in, and I met with him and talked about the part, and I had to read for him, which I did, and he gave me the part, and, you know, it was great.
I actually want to play a clip from Mr. Saturday Night.
Oh.
This movie was written and directed by Billy Crystal,
mm-hmm.
and Crystal played an old-time comic named Buddy, and you were his brother. You started off as a brother act, and then as you both got older, you became the manager, and the Billy Crystal character remained the comic, the often obnoxious comic.
Right.
And you, as the manager, were often taken advantage of by the Billy Crystal character. So the movie basically spans most of your lives. And here's a scene from when you're both older. Billy Crystal is really washed up. He's just bombed at a senior citizen's date, and a cruise ship date has just been canceled. And you're telling him that you're kind of giving up on this and you're ready to move to Florida to retire.
That was a chance for you. But you did what you always do. You screwed it up with nastiness and craziness, and I'm supposed to clean it up. Well, I am tired of being a guy that follows the elephant act with a shovel.
Don't flatter yourself,
buddy. It's over.
Answer me one question and be perfectly honest with me.
What?
Am I still funny?
Oh, buddy, don't.
No, because I will trust your opinion. If you say to me that I'm not funny, then I will also retire tonight right here. I'll eat a damn lychee nut and go to bed.
Would you please
stop? But if I am funny, then you're a damn quitter and you're letting me down.
Oh, God, I can't
stand it. So tell me, am I funny or am I not funny?
Will you stop it?
Am I funny or
not funny?
Will
you just stop it already,
buddy? Am I funny or not funny? Tell me, am I...
You're not that funny.
The character you played on Mr. Saturday Night, it seems like the opposite side of the coin from the character that you play in Quiz Show. You look similar in terms of like the eyeglasses and everything in both roles. It's the same period. But in Mr. Saturday Night, you're always getting taken advantage of. And in Quiz Show, you're the one taking advantage of others.
Right. Isn't that beautiful?
You know, what goes around comes around.
Yeah, I love when that happens. That's one of the reasons that I was so attracted to the role of Dan Enright, because it was so different. And I think after Mr. Saturday Night, maybe people were thinking, gee, that, you know, that David Paymer, he's such a mensch, you know, he's such a nice guy, you know. And I have read for some, quote, bad guys in the past 2 years, and I haven't got the parts. So I hope that people are seeing the dark side of David Paymer. You know, maybe this will open up a new range for me.
You've told us a little bit about how you carried yourself, that whole economy of motion, in a power role. In Mr. Saturday Night, when you're somebody who's being taken advantage of by your brother, how do you carry yourself differently? How do you use your voice differently?
Well, a lot of Mr. Saturday Night was listening because, I mean, I learned early on when Billy and I were doing some improvs and stuff in rehearsal that it's pretty hard to top Billy when you're improvising, you know? And I felt a little inadequate in trying to come up with jokes that were as funny as Billy's. And I said that to Billy early on, and he said to me, "That's perfect." And I said, "Why?" He said, "That's how Stan feels. You know, Stan always wants to be as funny as Buddy, and he wants to be in front of the audience, but he doesn't quite have it." So I used that reality in terms of how I felt, not being a stand-up comic, trying to sort of, you know, verbally spar with Billy. And also, I don't know, I just had there was a lot of emotional stuff from my childhood and from my own relationship with my brother that I used in Mr. Saturday Night as well.
Well, you and your brother used to do a comedy act together.
Yes, we did.
What kind of act was it?
Not very good.
What else was it like?
Well, it was actually when we first moved to L.A. I'm very close with my brother, Steve. He's a comedy writer himself on Mad About You and now the new show Madman of the People. And he played at Merv Griffin and I would be Sylvester Stallone and I would be Nicholson and we'd do all these impressions and, you know, we soon found that it wasn't really for us. I mean, being a comedian is kind of like being a salesman, and I don't think I would be a very good salesman. You know, talking people into buying things that they don't really want. I'm not very good at that. And a comedian is like, well, you know, I got these jokes. Do you want to buy them? Do you like them? You don't like them. You're not buying. And it felt like that a lot. So I sort of stuck with acting, and my brother went into writing. I've done some writing as well, but more recently it's been mostly acting for me.
Is your father in show business?
Well, he is, actually. He's a musician, and he's also has a doctor of musicology. He went back to school later in life, and but he's a very talented pianist and a composer. And you know, when my brother and I were kids, my parents used to put on shows that they wrote and directed and produced on Long Island. Community shows. And I'm from Oceanside, Long Island, and my folks wrote a show called Oceanside USA, and they did it to raise money for the public library and stuff like that. And I can remember when I was 5 or 6 years old sitting in the front row and seeing my dad, like, conducting this little orchestra he put together and my mom on stage acting. And so, gee, I guess it was in the blood, you know.
Actor David Paymer is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Paymer. In the film Quiz Show, he plays the producer of the rigged game show. You started off in musicals, didn't you, as an actor? I know you were in Grease. I know that was one of your early big breaks.
Yeah, that was really my first break, the show Grease. And I did, you know, I did all the musical comedies back in high school. That was the big thing. I suppose it still is in most high schools.
So did you like Grease?
It was a great experience. It's, you know, it's a fun show, and I was 21 years old, mm-hmm. and I was just out of college, and I walked into an open call, and I got the part, and I did the national touring company, and then they sent me to Broadway within a year, and it was like, it was a dream come true. I mean, that, to this day, that's the most important job I ever got in show business, because I wasn't the type of person or actor who would have stuck it out for like 10 years or 12 years waiting tables. I don't think I had the constitution for that. And I was very lucky to have a measure of success at such a young age.
We know between Grease, Mr. Saturday Night, and Quiz Show, a lot of your roles have been in the 1950s.
I know. It's weird. I mean, I was reading some of the notices on Quiz Show, and one of them said, you know, and David Paymer, who has, you know, this quintessential 1950s face.
No, what does that mean?
I have no idea. You know, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm glad because it's worked out.
Have you gone back and looked at family photos from the 50s to see what your family looked like back in the period that you've been playing?
Well, yeah, and I mean, especially my dad, because he just the hair and that whole look, it just, I don't know, it seems like almost artificial now, but it's, you know, it's, that's the way people were. Also, for Enright, there was sort of a, actually it gained a little weight for Enright, because there was sort of a softness to these guys. You know, these guys weren't working out, they were smoking and drinking, and I don't think they took very good care of themselves. And you can look back at the 50s, and these guys who were relatively young really look kind of puffy. So I was going for that at the time.
I have in my mind cast you in two different roles in movie biographies. One is a biopic of George C. Scott, The Early Years.
Thank you.
And the other is George Mitchell, The Early Years. I don't know why.
Can I play him when he's baseball commissioner?
Right. But this is in your 1950s guys with those glasses.
Yeah, right.
Right? I mean, not you as yourself. Actually, I've never seen you as yourself.
That's
in New York and I'm in Philadelphia, so I have no idea what you look like out of character.
I look much better than I do on, I'm telling you. I have no ego whatsoever in my film roles. And I don't wear glasses. This is what's killing me.
Not at all? Not even contact lenses?
It's killing me. No, I don't wear glasses. And yet, in many of my screen roles, I wear glasses. I don't know. I'm going to have to stop doing that.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. I thank you a lot.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
David Paymer stars in Quiz Show. For a band that's always been associated with cutting-edge alternative rock, it's surprising to realize that Monster is REM's 10th album. Ken Tucker has a review.
I'm looking for an interruption. Do you believe? You look in the dead my dreams. Be prepared for anything. You come into my little scene. Hooray.
I've been resisting the acclaim accorded to REM for more than a decade now. To my ears, they've always been interesting in an arty, intelligent, self-conscious way, but also bloodless and rarely emotionally engaging. The obvious symbol of this is the famous unintelligibility of Michael Stipe's vocals. Swallowing words in a tone that implies great inner turmoil without actually defining it, Stipe's voice is a kind of Rorschach test for Generation X. It expresses whatever sort of ennui that's going around at the moment. So one reason I think Monster is the best album REM has ever put out is that it's both aggressive and specific. The advance word on Monster is that it's the return of REM as a good old loud rock and roll band, but that sells this collection short. It's full of all sorts of departures for the group. One of the best songs is one of its quietest and most unusual stylistically. Listen to the way Michael Stipe does his own wobbly but lovely version of Smokey Robinson's falsetto on a song called Tongue. One of the things I've always held against REM is its portentousness. When you go out of your way to obscure your lyrics and arrange your melodies in a way that makes them sound as if you're offering profound revelations, you're courting self-importance. But the music on Monster is down and dirty. On a tune called I Took Your Name, Stipe even growls, "I wanna be Iggy Pop," just the sort of obstreperous rock star that REM was conceived as a reaction against. For sheer unpredictability, REM deserves a lot of credit.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Monster, the new album from REM. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Former St. Louis Cardinals pitcher Bob Gibson intimidated hitters with his glowering demeanor and his lightning fastball. He was the only pitcher to win the seventh and deciding game of the World Series twice. In 1981, he was voted into baseball's Hall of Fame. Coming up, we talk with Gibson. He has a new autobiography. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the latest book to uphold the literary canon, Harold Bloom's New Guide to Western Literature. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton visited the personnel stationed on the aircraft carrier Eisenhower today. He expressed his appreciation to the personnel aboard for their hard work in the Haiti operation.
Thanks to your efforts, the Haitian people are moving from fear to freedom. Thanks to your efforts, the democratically elected government will soon return to power. Thanks to your efforts, the world knows that the United States will stand up for human rights and against slaughter, stand up for democracy, honor our commitments, and expect those who make commitments to us to honor them as well.
A published report alleges the CIA may have supported a pro-army militia group in Haiti. The Nation magazine says U.S. officials helped launch the right-wing group called FROP to counter the pro-democracy movement led by President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Members of the FROP group are accused of torturing and killing scores of Aristide's supporters. A team of 30 police officers has left Israel for Haiti to join the International Peacekeeping Force. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli Police Minister Moshe Shachal said it's the first time that Israel is participating in an international force to bring democracy to another part of the world. He also said the Israeli police officers would monitor human rights in Haiti, but would not be actively involved in policing. The team left after the Israeli Supreme Court rejected a petition by an ultranationalist Jewish settler that Israelis should not be involved in police actions abroad. Police Minister Shachal said the move signaled a new era of Israeli involvement in international affairs. He said Israel was committed to keeping the team in Haiti for 4 to 6 months, but might change personnel after 3 months. The United States had requested Israel's participation in the multinational force. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A very large rail merger could be in the wind. The board of Santa Fe Pacific is thinking about a $3.4 billion bid from Union Pacific. Santa Fe had already agreed to merge with Burlington Northern 4 months ago, but Union Pacific stepped forward this week with another deal. Union Pacific has made the bid with an eye toward keeping its place as the nation's biggest rail firm. The bid is an all-stock offer. Several major stores are reporting increased retail sales for September. JCPenney says sales rose 9% last month in stores that have been open for at least a year. Sears saw a nearly 5% increase. Other retailers who are seeing gains include Kmart and Walmart. Some analysts say back-to-school shopping probably was a big factor. They also say this looks good for the upcoming holiday shopping season. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow fell almost 12 points to end at 3,775. Declining issues edged advances in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The chairman of the NAACP says a conspiracy has been formed to drive him from power. William Gibson says the same factions that ousted former executive director Benjamin Chavis are now out to get him. He's denying charges raised by columnist Carl Rowan. Rowan alleges Gibson dipped thousands of dollars from the civil rights organizations into his expense account. Gibson says his enemies within the NAACP are feeding lies to the media to sway opinion in advance of a board of directors meeting later this month. Gibson says the efforts to discredit him will fail. The bodies of 16 Bosnian Serb soldiers and 4 Serbian military nurses have been found outside Sarajevo after a surprise attack. The UN says it was most likely carried out by government forces. From Zagreb, Richard Carruthers has details.
The attack, being blamed on the Muslim-led Bosnian army, came in the early hours near Mount Igman, south of Sarajevo. The area is supposed to be demilitarized, but the UN had reported a build-up of Bosnian troops in recent days. After the fighting died down, French peacekeepers found the corpses of the Bosnian Serb soldiers and nurses. Many, they said, had been mutilated or burnt. The Bosnian Serb army that surrounds Sarajevo has protested to the UN over the incident. Special Envoy Yasushiro Kashi expressed grave concern to Bosnian President Alija Izetbegovic and asked for maximum restraint from all warring parties. The UN had hoped tensions were easing in the Bosnian capital after Serbs and Muslims exchanged 300 prisoners of war and the airport reopened after 2 weeks' disuse. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
Algiers police report a high school teacher was killed today in a town east of the capital. It's the second teacher slain in as many days. The education ministry says Islamic extremists have burned or sabotaged more than 600 schools in recent weeks. Schools have been a target of armed fundamentalist groups who've waged an insurgency against the army-backed government. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Baseball Hall of Famer Bob Gibson is one of the greatest pitchers in history. He won the National League's Most Valuable Player Award in 1968, the year he won 22 games, led the league with 268 strikeouts, and had an earned run average of 1.12, a major league record. He shut out every team except the Dodgers. During his career with the St. Louis Cardinals, he had a reputation for not talking much with the press and for revealing as little as possible about himself. But he reflects on his life and career in his new autobiography, Stranger to the Game. He told me he didn't like to take orders from his catcher.
I felt if you throw a pitch that you don't want to pitch, you're not going to have your heart in it and it's not going to be good. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you when that happened. I remember back when I was very, very young, and you do have to pay attention to what other people think about the league and the hitters when you don't know them yourself. Carl Sawatzky was a catcher for the Cardinals, and he and I had a disagreement about what pitch to throw to a hitter. And I was young, and he was experienced. And I would shake him off, and he finally called timeout, and he came out to the mound to tell me that he wanted me to throw a certain pitch. Well, when he went back, got down, and I threw that pitch, the guy hit a home run. And from that point on, I said, I'll never do it again. Now, that's not to say that you don't take orders or you don't follow what the catcher wants you to do. But if you don't want to do it, then I say don't do it.
Now, Tim McCarver was your catcher for many years. How did he feel about that?
Well, he felt the same way. You never throw a pitch that you don't want to throw. And usually a catcher like McCarver had his head in the game so much, and he was so smart about what he was doing back there that I didn't shake him off that often anyway. When I did shake, it was usually to confuse the hitter.
You used to use the brushback pitch. Tell me about your strategy for when the brushback would be the appropriate way to pitch to someone.
Well, when I played, that's the way the game was played. And the brushback pitch really isn't what it sounds like. What you do, you throw the ball in off the plate. The idea of getting a hitter out, you don't get him out inside. You get him out away. And so what the hitter tries to do in order to keep that ball away from being away, they'll lean over the plate, and then the ball away is more or less either from the middle of the plate in. So you don't want him to lean over. You pitch inside off of the plate. Now you make him think about that ball coming in here. And if he's not thinking about it coming in there, probably it will hit him. So what the hitter likes to do is to either look for the ball inside or look for it away. To keep him from looking for it away, you throw him inside, get him off the plate, which people call a brushback pitch, and then you throw him away.
I guess you know your aim has to be awfully good if you're pitching inside when the batter's crowding the plate, otherwise you'll hit the batter.
Right, I didn't hit batters that often. And they knew that I would pitch inside. And this is one of the weapons that you have. If you throw inside often enough, they know that you're going to come in here. So they're aware of the ball being inside, and that's why you're so effective away. Very seldom will you hit a guy inside. If you want to hit him, you don't throw it inside anyway. You throw it behind him.
Why?
Well, because the first instinct is to move back. And so if you throw a ball behind a guy and he moves back, usually it'll hit him.
Now, were there times when you intentionally tried to hit a batter?
Oh, sure. And usually that was retaliation. We had a couple of guys, Lou Brock, Curt Flood, and Julian Javier. They got hit constantly. They were very fast. They get on the bases and they just drove you guys nuts. So they did get hit. And whenever one of my guys got hit when I was pitching, I would just return the favor.
Now, you hit Duke Snyder once and broke his elbow.
Oh, he hit himself.
He hit himself?
Yeah.
Why don't you explain that?
Well, Duke Snyder was a pull hitter, dead pull hitter, and he liked the ball inside. He's a left-hand hitter, and they first moved out to the Coliseum. And the Coliseum's right field fence was a long way away, but the left field fence was only 250 feet away, and Duke Snyder did not hit the ball to left field. First time I faced him, he hit a home run over that little fence out there, which was fine. You know, okay, I'm going to have to start pitching him a little differently. I pitched him away a little farther, about 3 or 4 inches outside, and he reached out and hit the ball. It would have been a home run, but it went foul, and that was the second time up. Well, the next pitch I threw him was inside. Here we go with this pitch that I'm telling you. It keeps the guy from leaning out. Well, he went back out there thinking that the ball was going to be outside, and it hit him in the elbow, broke his elbow.
How did you feel when that happened?
Oh, it was his fault. It wasn't mine. And in fact, I went over to talk to him after the game, and he told me, he says, I was leaning out there, and I shouldn't have been doing it.
Hmm. Did you ever get hit while you were at bat?
Sure. I got hit a lot.
Was that retribution against your pitching?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it was the way the game was played.
Boy, so every time you intentionally hit a batter, did you figure, well, that means I'm going to get hit when I'm at
well,
bat?
Well, we're making it sound like...
Like it happened a lot of times, which it didn't.
Yeah, and it didn't happen that
right.
often. See, you got a guy back there called the umpire, and he usually stops all of this.
Right.
When somebody gets hit on my team, and I go back out there, and I hit somebody on that team, the umpire will call timeout. He says, okay, guys, that's enough. And usually that is enough, and it stops.
Right.
So you don't spend all game throwing at each other.
Mm-hmm, right. Just tell me more about what your strategy was like when you were on the mound.
All right. We would go into a town, for instance, going into Philadelphia, and we have a three-game series. The first game of each series, we have a report from the scouts, and we would go over each individual hitter. We knew exactly how to pitch them, how to play defense against them. And so what you would do, you would go over it and refresh your memory on what to do. So that's not to say that you would pitch like that all the time. But if you got into a situation where this guy could beat you with a base hit or a home run or what have you, then you went to your strategy. You went to those scouting reports. And pretty much if you stayed there, you'd get the guy out. But if you were continually pitching a guy according to that, he was going to – most of those hitters are good enough to adjust to that. So you try not to pitch them like that all the time.
Baseball Hall of Famer Bob Gibson is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Baseball Hall of Famer Bob Gibson is my guest. He has a new autobiography. It was, I think, in the summer of 1967, you were hit above your ankle by a line drive, and you stayed in the game and kept pitching, in spite of the fact that you were hit. How did you manage to play, given you had a broken bone?
Well, I wasn't aware that the bone was broken to begin with. I got hit with a line drive off of the bat of Roberto Clemente. And the trainer came out and sprayed my ankle with ethyl chloride, you know, and that freezes everything. It took the pain away. In fact, I didn't know my foot was still there. And so I continued to pitch because I had no feeling in it. And then I finally tried to throw one pitch a little too hard, and I popped the bone, the small bone, and that made me quit. I fell down, and we went right directly to the hospital and didn't pass go.
Did you hear the sound?
Oh, yeah, I heard it.
That's an awful sound, huh?
It was this awful sound, and the pain was excruciating. And I didn't realize that the bone had broken. When I heard that sound, I looked around to see what it was. For an instant, it sounded like somebody was behind me and popped their hands together. And then I went down, and I knew what it was.
Looking back, are you sorry that you kept playing?
Oh, if I had it to do over again, Sure. In fact, if that were to happen today, they take a little bit better care of the players than they did back in those days.
They wouldn't have let you keep going.
They wouldn't have let me.
You know, Tim McCarver tells this story of the time you broke a strikeout record during the World Series, and he was trying to call your attention to the fact that that it was on the scoreboard. On the scoreboard, it said Gibson's 15th strikeout in one game ties the all-time World Series record held by Sandy Koufax. And he kept pointing, and you kept yelling, "Throw the ball," because you had no idea what he was trying to get your attention for.
So, absolutely no idea.
So how did you feel when you actually turned around and realized that, A, that you'd broken the record, and B, that it was on the scoreboard?
Well, those kind of things really aren't things that I'm concerned about, especially in the heat of the battle.
Really, you're not thrilled by breaking a record?
Not right then, no. It means a lot more to you 20 years from then when you're sitting back and sipping on a glass of wine and thinking about what you accomplished. But during the time, no, it's not really that big a deal. Not just with me. I don't think with too many people.
Hmm.
Not for professionals. When you're an amateur and you do something for the first time, I think there's a little bit different feeling.
I think you were the first black athlete to get a scholarship to the college that you went to. And you got
Creighton University.
Did you get a scholarship in basketball and baseball?
No. It was a basketball scholarship, and I just happened to play baseball during the summer, yeah.
So did you think that you would go into basketball at that time?
I thought I was going to be a basketball player, more so than a baseball player. But when I got to be a senior, I thought that maybe, and it didn't seem like anybody was interested that much in me from the professional ranks, I thought maybe I would probably end up in baseball.
You actually played with the Globetrotters for a while, and oh, was it around 57?
Yeah, 1957.
And you roomed with Meadowlark Lemon.
Yes, I did.
But you say you hated the clowning, which is what the Globetrotters were most famous for.
Yes, but I didn't know that at the time because the Globetrotters came into Omaha, and in 1957 and I guess a year or two before that, they had a series with the College All-Stars where they played real basketball. And so I played with the College All-Stars, and I didn't really get to play until the last quarter. I scored a lot of points, and we ended up beating the Globetrotters. Well, they asked me to go with them after that. And so that following fall, I went into Chicago, worked out, made the team. And when we started playing, we started doing the clowning thing. And I didn't realize at first that's what it was. So I didn't really care for that, no.
Why not?
I'm not a clown.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard to learn the stunts that the Globetrotters did?
No, it's not hard at all. If you, it's really funny. When you're young, you spin the ball on your finger and you do some of those things. I don't know why you do it, but when it came time to play, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to play basketball.
You said before that breaking records didn't really mean much to you at the time. What did it mean to you to get voted into the Hall of Fame in 1980?
81,
okay.
Yeah, he, going into the Hall of Fame is something that nobody really thinks about while they're playing. And after you finish your career, whatever it is, and you sit down and you think about it, the best thing that could possibly ever happen to you after you get through playing is to go into the Hall of Fame. And when I was inducted, first of all, I thought I would never be inducted because I didn't, you know, the guys that vote on you were reporters. And I didn't talk with reporters a lot, especially on the day that I pitched. I tried to stay away because they would distract you. So I never thought I was going to go into the Hall of Fame. And in fact, I was prepared not to be selected. They called me and told me that they were going to have the voting and, you know, there was a good chance that I would go in there. So I pretty much resigned myself to the fact that I wasn't going to go in because I didn't think the reporters liked me. But after I went in, after they had the election and I went in, I don't think there's any other feeling greater than that, knowing that they thought, and by they I mean the press and the people that watched you play, thought you were one of the best players ever. It was a great feeling.
What have you been doing since your retirement?
I make a lot of speeches here and there and do a lot of interviews, public appearances. I've done some broadcasting. I ran a restaurant, started a bank. You name it, I did it. I tried some of everything.
And what have you enjoyed the most?
Broadcasting the games, I really do enjoy that. I did that for about 10 years, and I got away from it for 1 year. I was trying something new. And one thing I did find out, when you try to get back, it's very difficult, because in broadcasting, most sports, they like to get the fresh new names out there. And so it's really difficult to get back in there right now, but I'm still hoping.
Does your arm ever give you trouble now?
Let me tell you, when you play sports, you have aches and pains the rest of your life, and it's all a part of what you do. You take some aspirins, and you have a glass of wine, and you forget it.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay.
Bob Gibson, his new autobiography is called Stranger to the Game. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. In Bosnia and Sarajevo, the bodies of 20 Serbs have been found, killed and mutilated in an attack by Bosnian government troops, 16 soldiers and 4 nurses. South Africa's President Nelson Mandela speaks before Congress here in Washington, calling on the United States to take a strong role in doing away with tyranny and poverty around the world. Michael Scholar reports from a village in Rwanda that's coming back together after the violence in the spring. The village is now mostly Hutu, with a few Tutsi. Dan Charles reports on the failed promise of high-speed trains in this country. And Linda Wertheimer has a conversation with the actress Lauren Bacall.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For nearly 40 years, Harold Bloom has been one of the most important, controversial, and some say arrogant, literary critics in America. Bloom has just added to his outsized reputation with the publication of his latest book, The Western Canon, in which he offers a comprehensive reading guide to the masterworks of Western literature. Critic Maureen Corrigan has some thoughts on whether Bloom's book is as essential as its subjects.
There's a real doomsday feeling to Harold Bloom's massive book, The Western Canon. It's as though the aged Bloom has become King Lear. Bloom as Lear surveys a literary wasteland where multiculturalist academic parasites now feed on the bones of dead white male authors. He sees a future when what were once called departments of English will be renamed departments of cultural studies. Bloom howls. Batman comics, Mormon theme parks, television, movies, and rock will replace Chaucer, Shakespeare, Milton, Wordsworth, and Wallace Stevens. You may scoff at the egotism of this notoriously egotistical critic who imagines that when he goes, literary studies as we know it will go with him. But there's some truth to Bloom's vision. With artful dodging, students today can graduate college without reading The Canterbury Tales or Bleak House. Bloom believes they need to, but not for the moral uplift that conservative defenders of the canon say it provides. Bloom cherishes the canon for old-fashioned aesthetic reasons. He says that works become canonical because of their strangeness, their originality. Bloom powerfully reintroduces us to the otherness, the absolute weirdness of works like the Divine Comedy that over the centuries have become encrusted with a dulling reverence. It's the brilliance of Bloom's close readings that makes somebody like me, who's taught courses in detective fiction and women's studies, want to put up with all of his run-for-cover rantings about the barbarians at the gates. Bloom divides his book into 26 sections, where he discusses the work of those authors he thinks are central to the Western canon. The usual suspects line up: Shakespeare, Cervantes, Joyce, Wolfe, along with some surprises, like the Portuguese poet Fernando Pessoa. This brief list of mega immortals inevitably promises too much and too little. On the one hand, there are, Bloom concedes, a few dozen other extraordinary writers who don't make the cut. For example, Dostoevsky, Yeats, and Flaubert. On the other hand, even the amazing Bloom, who, it's been claimed, has memorized all of Paradise Lost, and who some people believe has read more books than any other human on the planet. Even he doesn't do full justice to everyone on his own list. On Dickinson and Freud, he's sublime. On George Eliot and Tolstoy, eh. At the white-hot center of the canon, Bloom places Shakespeare, the greatest writer of prose and poetry in the West. Resurrecting his trademark contribution to literary criticism, Bloom demonstrates how almost all the other writers here have to manage their anxiety about Shakespeare's influence. This even includes that top diagnostician of other people's anxieties, Sigmund Freud. For all its wisdom, what bothers me about the Western canon is how Bloom flatly dismisses all critical approaches to literature other than a purely aesthetic one. Marxism, deconstruction, feminism, you name it, Bloom thinks it's all reductive. As he says, a political reading of Shakespeare is bound to be less interesting than a Shakespearean reading of politics. Maybe, but we've learned things from political readings too. Bloom argues there's not world enough and time for all kinds of interpretations or books, but he doth protest too much. Even he reads science fiction. Come to think of it, that should surprise no one. Standing amidst the detritus of our age, knee-deep in Fabio videos and reruns of The Love Boat, this astonishing and exasperating man is nothing if not a stranger in a strange land.
Maureen Carrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Western Canon by Harold Bloom. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Barbara Bogave, research assistance from Becky Cohn. Our theme music is composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The O.J. Simpson trial has turned America into a country of amateur forensic scientists. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with one of America's leading forensic pathologists, Dr. Michael Baden. In fact, he's now working with the Simpson defense team. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.